What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another week, another episode of Around the World. And today we have an awesome guest joining us with an awesome story, awesome youth career leading up to his time in the States. So we're super excited to get into it. But a little bit of background on Daniel Nessler. So Daniel played for Bayer Leverkusen Academy from the U13 level to the U19 level. Meanwhile, he was a part of the German youth national team from U16 to U19 and played around 25 games during that time span. And at the U17 level, the German team that was captained by Daniel went through the Euros and World Cup qualifying circuit. And this team featured massive stars, one being Kai Havertz, which is awesome. We can't wait to discuss that. And then after, you know, his time in the youth ranks ended, Daniel moved on to a professional level. So he moved to FC Cologne in 2017 and played there for 2 years in the fourth tier of Germany. And then after that, moved on to Wuppertal SV for 2 more years, and then decided to come to the States, where he is now playing at Drexel University. So Daniel, thanks for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Drex. Thanks, Dylan, for having me here. It's a big pleasure, and I can't wait to answer all your questions.
Yeah, man, we got a lot for you. But no, as we always do before we get into all the soccer stuff, just checking in, just talking about anything. So one thing that we were thinking about was, you know, we've had a lot of European guys that have made that move to the States on our podcast so far. And kind of one thing we haven't hit on is just the whole language barrier piece and how that plays a role in everything. So can you talk to us about when you learned English and if you did see that language barrier when you came to Philadelphia and went to Drexel?
Yeah, of course. So basically, I started speaking and learning English when I was maybe like 6 or 7, so pretty early already. I kind of have a family connection to the US. My parents lived here in New York for a couple of years before I was born. So, you know, like we were kind of talking English sometimes. We were flying to the US a couple of times during my high school time, for example. So I was always kind of connected to speaking English. And then I had like a performance class in high school for English. So that was a very good preparation overall for learning English before coming to the US. And yeah, I did my undergrad. We will talk about that later, but I did my undergrad and I also had like 1 or 2 classes in English. And then I just kept going with it, you know, like watching a lot of YouTube videos. Nowadays with social media, everything is kind of in English. So that was pretty easy for me to keep up on the same level or keep the same level. And I would say in comparison maybe to like other players that I've met already in the US, I wouldn't say that the barrier was that big or high for me before coming to the US. I was pretty good in understanding everything. Of course, you have like some slangs, accents here, depending on where you are, but especially in Philly probably. But it was definitely doable for me. And I think it's just hands-on experience at the end of the day, you know, like as soon as you're in an environment where you have a lot of people speaking English, like your teammates are speaking in English, classmates, everyone you are actually talking to. We don't have, like, we only had one German athlete in the whole athletes department here at Drexel. Oh, wow. So there was no chance for me to speak German. So that was pretty good.
Yeah, I was going to say, coming over to the States and being in Philly specifically, there's a few things that aren't in the dictionary that you got to pick up. So
I'm sure. For sure. Yeah, no, that's funny. I was going to say the same thing, though.
It's getting better. It's getting better with time and getting used to it. But Daniel, yeah, thanks so much for joining us, man. You've been through it all in soccer, and you have so much to share with us and our listeners today. So we're really pumped. Just to get started, you grew up as a player in the Bayer Leverkusen Youth Academy, and that's obviously a huge club, not only in Germany, but in the world. So can you talk to us about that and what it was like growing up in that system and how that really affected your development as a player?
Yeah, of course. So as you guys know, of course, we have a different education system for soccer and the academical part in Germany. So clubs and the academical part are separated from each other. So you basically have your classes, and then in the evening, for example, you have your normal training sessions. Bayer Leverkusen was very famous for their youth academy at that time. They are still famous for this academy, but they had a like impressive ratio of players actually making it to professional levels during that time. So it was pretty tough to stay at Leverkusen, or you know, like to make it to the next stage, to the next age. And overall, I would say the competitiveness was pretty intense at Leverkusen. You know, you have to deliver every day, almost every weekend. We had a lot of tournaments. It's probably the same here with youth academies right now here in the US. If I look at the Union, for example, here in Philadelphia. And yeah, we were just like continuing. I gave my best to make it to the next level, And in Leverkusen, we had a special system because we didn't have a U16. So once you made it from the U15 to the next level, you were directly put into the U17. So there was a step where you were actually, like our team was reduced by half in my age. And I got to play with players that were 1 year older than me. And that was a huge step for younger players, you know, competing not only with your same age, but with older players mm-hmm. for one season. Of course, once you reach the older age, you are the older guy in the team. So that's an advantage, of course, but also more responsibility at the end of the day. And we had the same step from the U17 to the U19. So we didn't have a U16 and we didn't have a U18, which was, in my opinion, very good for your education. It was tough, of course, because again, half of the team was cut off. But overall, you had to bring up a lot of discipline, a lot of like good work ethic to, you know, like to compete, to be able to play, to be better than an older player. And yeah, there, I faced a lot of, I wouldn't say problems, but I faced a lot of situations where I learned a lot, especially during this first year of the U17. And I took that to my, you know, like further education to the national team also. Which helped me a lot.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. And right there, what you're saying, like we see the difference between here in the US, just in one example, and specifically being the fact that, you know, to be at that top tier academy as Leverkusen was in Germany, you know, it's very ultra competitive. And there's kind of one destination where they're bringing in all the best players, right? And more so in the United States here, you see, especially when me and Dylan were going through it, you know, we see a lot of teams around the same area that are competing at that same highest level in the academy system. So it is still competitive to get to that point, but maybe not as competitive. And that's kind of leading into my next point. So you were talking about like how, you know, every year was a competitive making it to the next age group. So I'm wondering, like, I don't know if there's any instances specifically or just in general, how like when players would come in, could you see the coaches maybe like favoring like the guys that were there, or this is the new talent coming in, this is like this is exciting and new, am I going to go with that? Or was there some loyalty there in general? I'm just more curious about that.
That's actually a good question. So I mean, we were debating that a lot during the time that we, you know, like went from level to level, and we were always like, okay, we got this player coming in. We had players and this is kind of crazy, of course, when you think about it, but we had players coming in from, I don't know, like Leipzig or Frankfurt, you know, like where families were moving for them at the age of 14 or 15 just to be able to play for Leverkusen. And this is pressure, of course, you know, when you have your daily life and you have to think about stuff like that. It's kind of crazy. But I would say the first time that we were actually thinking about it more seriously was when we made the step from the U15 to the U17. Because in Germany, legally, you have to have a contract to play on that level. So the club, that was like a motivation for the club to bring in very good players from, you know, like other cities around in Germany mm-hmm. And actually pay them a little bit more money than the other players in the mm-hmm. team that are currently in the team, mm-hmm. which is kind of the same as on professional, like on the top tier levels in senior soccer. Mm-hmm. And then we were actually realizing, okay, there might be the case, or it might be the case that coaches have to prefer external players because, you know, they are getting maybe a little bit more more attention, more money, whatever it is. And that was, yeah, we had like players that were earning a lot of money in the U19, for example, still at the age of 18, where you're like, wow, that's insane. But I have to say, just looking at my experience, whether it's like youth academy or senior experience, coaches always prefer players. And I would say it's maybe there was one coach that didn't prefer a specific player because he was very like performance oriented, you know, like looking at every practice mm-hmm. session. But normally you're in favor of the coach, maybe not, depending on your character, on your skill, on what the coach actually wants to see. So this is always a very tough question to talk about.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear you talk about it in that way, because we see something kind of similar, you know, with college soccer, in that there's recruits coming in every year. Maybe one of them is a big recruit from a big team or coming over from Europe like yourself and is a top player. And that's something that guys have to consider. And then there's the scholarships that play into it and all everything that goes into that. So it's really interesting to hear how in your situation, you were dealing with that at 14 years old, though. So a lot of college kids are 18 to 22 to 23. You're still in the what would be middle school in America, and you're saying, oh, is there a guy coming from all the way from Leipzig to take my spot? That's a lot on your plate at a young age. And that's a difference still, you know, between America and Europe that America was working on. And like we talk about in many of our episodes, these academies are coming and they're developing these regime or tactics and ideas the same as there is in Europe. But it's a big character builder at a young age, I can imagine. But Daniel, talk to us a little bit what it's like playing for Bayer Leverkusen, a very established team. I'm sure you had a style of play. You guys didn't just turn up to the park and say, let's figure it out. So what's it like playing in such a top academy, and what was that like as far as your style?
Yeah, so as you guys were saying already, Leverkusen was one of the top teams in Germany on the youth level, also on the like senior level, but especially also on the youth level. We had our Bundesliga, youth Bundesliga divisions separated into three Bundesligas. So we were playing the Western region, the Western Bundesliga. Mm-hmm. And we were actually competing with Dortmund, Schalke, Cologne every year. So in order to make it to the top, you have to be dominant. So you here in the US, I sometimes have the feeling, you know, like you don't have to be like super technical. Sometimes you can only have fast players, you know, like dominate the game this way. But in Germany, that was maybe like the biggest difference. If you want to be on top and if you want to dominate in games, you got to see that you are technically extremely good, that you are tactically extremely good. There was something where we were always pushed towards, you know, like our coaches were always always telling us, okay, we want to build up from the back. Doesn't matter what, you know, like that's going to happen every practice session. Of course, we are not naive or like stupid at some point. You know, there are situations where, I don't know, like you have to kick the ball away. Mm-hmm. But normally, like the foundation should always be, okay, we start from the back, hold possession, you know, let the opponent run until we will find a spot where we can, you know, like go up front, score a goal, but control, never like hectic or like the best case was always, and I sometimes I like to remember that time because again it's very very different here in the US, but basically, you know, like when I was playing center back or a center midfielder back then in Germany, we were pushing them into their half and we were like letting them run in their half, you know, like in front of their box. They didn't have a chance to get out when they were, you know, like smashing the ball away. We still like we did like counter pressing. We won the ball again. So this kind of playing, that was very typical for Leverkusen. Also, of course, depending on the coach, but the coaches that I had were always focusing on that. And that's why, in my opinion, Leverkusen was able to bring out so many players for, doesn't matter which kind of league in Germany, they were always able to adapt, not only because they were competitive and ambitious, but also because they had the tactical and technical abilities. There was something that was very important from early on, again, from the start, right from the start. I can never remember or I can't remember a year when we were like, okay, we're just going to kick the ball away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This is like definitely a theme we're seeing. Obviously you were at Bayer Leverkusen. It's very, very established, has a very set style of play and likes to execute that from all levels. But this is a theme we're seeing just in terms of US versus Europe, especially at the youth levels. We're seeing this technical and tactical expertise at a younger age, I would say, generally, which is something that is a little bit different. And, you hit on it a little bit when you were talking, but also just curious, like if you could highlight one or two things. So you come over to the US and you see the general style of play, specifically in college soccer, because obviously that's what you're playing. So obviously you're used to the possession counter pressing type, system. What if anything did you have to change from your game to kind of adjust to the American soccer?
I would say the biggest difference in general was just coming from possession to transition based or transition focused soccer. I haven't played that many games so far, so it was only one season in college soccer, but I heard that there are also, I don't know, like colleges like Clemson, for example, or teams like Clemson that actually want to play, like they kind of also dominate games with like technical stuff. Here at Drexel, we have a very decent team, but for me, like that was the biggest difference because we had players like Donner, for example, you guys know him, like he was very fast, so that was a strength of our team, like putting the ball in behind, running in behind, this kind of stuff, not having possession too much. We did a lot of progress, so I'm curious how it's going to be in the upcoming season, but that was a big difference that I had to adapt to, because I'm like a technical guy. I would consider myself being a technical guy at least. And I'm not that fast. I'm not super slow, but I'm also not fast. And here in the US, it's like a lot of things are based on athleticism. So, being fast and doesn't matter on which position. Like I faced a lot of players that maybe weren't technically that good, but just like super fast, and when you're having this transition based soccer, it's pretty tough to adapt to it out of nowhere or within a few weeks. So that was something that I really had to adapt to, and the rest, I played my whole life, or not my whole life, but since the U15, for example, I only played on natural grass. Here in the northeast, we only have turf, so that was also, it took me a while to adapt, to be honest, probably like 2 or 3 weeks in the beginning. I was happy that I was here 1 or 2 weeks before preseason started. That was helpful, so I could already go on by this here on our pitch and practice beforehand to adapt a little bit. But yeah, those were the two biggest differences or situations where I had to adapt.
Yeah, that's a big change, Daniel. And then you add on top of it, you're also moving from Germany to Philadelphia. So when you put all that together, it's definitely a lot. I can imagine, I wouldn't know, but it's definitely a lot that I would think to deal with. But it sounds like you're doing a really, really good job, and I'm sure there's continued success in your future. But Daniel, one thing that I was super interested when we were looking at your career, and one thing that stood out to me was the competitions that you got to take part in as a youth player in Bayer Leverkusen, especially to me was the UEFA Youth League. And not only were you able to participate in that and be part of the team, you were captain of that team, a team that included many, many players that are succeeding now in the professional ranks. So talk to us, what do you think set you aside as the guy to captain such a strong team and such an amazing competition, really the top competition for youth clubs in the world?
So that was a question that I asked myself many times, not during that time, not only during that time, but also afterwards. But I would say if you right now would go to each single player from my team back then, they will tell you that I was a guy who was always good with everyone in the team. You know, like I, for me, it didn't really matter where you're coming from. It didn't matter how much money you make or whatever, what kind of shoes you have when you come into the locker room. For me, it was always important to kind of like motivate players, talk to players. Yeah, being good with players. I also, I would say I'm really humble, you know, like grounded in comparison to other players. Not, you know, like not specifically specifically pointing at some other players, but I think we all know how it is in soccer or how it works sometimes. It's can happen really fast that you're like, you know, going going into a wrong direction. So that was something where I would say, okay, that's a good character or like a good requirement for being a captain. But also my style of playing during games. So so that was the part like off the pitch and like on the pitch. I know Drex, we play together. I'm a guy, I'm like I'm trying to be very loud during games. I'm trying to give commands, coach like from the back. Also depends on the position, of course. It's way easier to coach from the back than, you know, as you would be a striker, for example. So that was something where my coaches always appreciated that I was doing it, because we all know there are not like a lot of players normally on the pitch that are actually continuously talking during the game. So I would say those two things, and maybe just like a fun fact or fact from back then, like the first time that I was elected to be the captain for the U17 in Leverkusen, there was actually an election based on the votes from all my teammates. So it was not the decision by the coach. And I think this supports kind of like, you know, my standing in the team. I would say those two things are the two reasons for it.
No, awesome, man. And, you know, it's like an honor to have someone like you who on the show here and to get our, you know, our audience to listen to, because as you mentioned, like you could tell from how you've delivered everything, and, you know, you're just a very stand up, humble guy, and we appreciate that. And obviously, you know, your coaches appreciated that enough to give you the armband for, you know, one of the best competitions that we see in the world at the youth level. So, congrats on that. That's awesome, man. And,
thanks so much.
But yeah, so basically, like, as I mentioned in the beginning, we noticed through our research that on this team, on this, I believe it was the U17 team. I don't know if you played with him for multiple seasons, but Kai Havertz was there. And, you know, I don't know if one of the guys that you're talking about who has an ego is Kai Havertz, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, we'll leave it up to Kai Havertz to respond to this episode if if it was, but no. So, in all serious though, we're just wondering, what is it like playing like alongside a guy like that, you know, that, you know, you played with him obviously years ago at the youth level, but now seeing his career take off at Chelsea and for the first team in Germany, what was it like just like kind of looking back or in the moment, one of the two or both?
Maybe I can give you some unheard insights about Kai Havertz now.
definitely.
It's like so he was definitely not this kind of a typical soccer player that we talked about. He was also very humble for his position. Or like where he actually went after a short amount of time. So maybe to go back to the beginning when I first met Kai, that was actually in the U17. So he came up as a younger player. I was the older player or part of the older half of the team. And he was a very quiet person. So he was a kind guy, you know, like humble, kind of hardworking, but to be honest, not crazy good. So I think he played like most of the games, but not that he was like the best player on the team. But then I moved up to the U19, and I still had a very good connection to my to my younger teammates from the season before. And I watched some of their games, and this guy was growing so fast. Like he was, you know, like he started growing, I don't know, like probably, okay, the calculations are always a little bit different, but he was getting tall really quick. Suddenly he like dominated games against Schalke, against Dortmund, where I was standing on the side and I was like, whoa, that's impressive. Like I would never expected something like that from Kai. And then, yeah, like I was the older age again in the U19, he came up and I remember the first practice session. So he had a I think he already had a professional contract and he was going with our professional like first team to the preseason for like 2 weeks. He came back and I had the honor or pleasure to practice and play with him for, I don't know, like 5 more weeks, 6 more weeks. So we had like our first 4 season games. We played against Bochum, which is a very good team on the youth level in Germany. Cologne FC, for example, I think also Gladbach, whatever, like these kind of teams. And we just shredded them. Like we were winning 3-0, 4-0. And he was doing, I wouldn't say he was doing half the job, but it was insane. Like I was impressed, you know, standing in behind, standing in the back and just watching him him play against very good players that I knew for a long period of time that are also first division players now in Germany. And he just made it look easy. You know, like it's that's probably referring to the questions that you had. You can see the difference so fast, like after short amount of time, like his technical ability. He's extremely tall. I don't know if people realize that when they see him on TV, but he's very fast, very quick, even though it doesn't look like it sometimes on TV. But it's very hard to defend him because, again, I was defending him sometimes in practice. Couldn't do it all the time, but I gave my best. And yeah, he just deserves it, not only because he's a very good character, but also because he's just insane looking at his skills.
Yeah, that's so cool, man. And it's cool that you got to see him before he blew up. So you got to see the Kai Havertz, still the kid, still in the academy. And then you literally watched him grow in front of your eyes into a guy that can be considered maybe Chelsea's best player right now and one of the top players of your national team. So that's super cool, man. And I just got to ask you, is there any stories hidden away in the vaults, you and Kai hitting the town? I gotta ask.
Nah, it's I can't say anything, of course, about like secret stuff. I don't know. Like he was a little bit like sometimes he had like two personalities, which is kind of fun, you know. Like seeing him sometimes in his calm mood, you know, like just hanging around, just being super calm in the locker room. But he also had like his crazy 5 minutes sometimes. We were playing basketball sometimes in our back garden, and like we were having a lot of fun. Also going out sometimes, of course, which is also part of it. It was just fun hanging out with him, but also with the other guys that were younger age at that time. Again, like unfortunately, there's no story that I can actually tell. but there are of course some nice stories that you could potentially tell. But again, I'm unfortunately not allowed to do that.
maybe one day we'll just have Kai on and he can tell them. So.
Yeah, that would be crazy. If you can figure that out, that would be impressive.
No, that's funny. Awesome, and thanks for sharing all that, man. That's a really cool story, and you know, something you'll definitely tell your kids one day for sure. But so reeling it back in, I guess we want to keep moving along here with your career. So obviously you've had about 25 caps at the national team level, at the youth national team level. So can you take us inside your time with the German youth national team? Just take us inside and what was it like?
Yeah, of course. So everything started in the U15. We had like in Germany it works like this. We have a like overall countrywide tournament where you come together in like region, I don't know how to say that, like special teams that were like they were picking players from Leverkusen, from Cologne, from Dortmund, you know, like for those specific areas.
Yeah.
And like a talent development tournament, for example. And there were scouts from the national team. The actual coaches were there. Everything was happening over one weekend. And you could present yourself next to your normal club games. But that was a easier way for all the scouts to... I mean, we have a lot of clubs in Germany that are on a good level in the youth. So there was a chance for them to actually like look around, scout players. And we were actually winning, like my team was winning this whole tournament, and I was a decent part of it. So that was my chance of being seen. You guys know how it works. When you succeed, it's normally way easier to be seen. And yeah, I was, once I made it to the U16 in Leverkusen, the whole national team stuff started, and I joined the team. I was playing, and that was kind of crazy. That's maybe also a fun fact. I was playing U16 national team, even though I was only playing one game overall in my U16 or like U17 first year. That was kind of crazy because everyone else in the national team was, you know, playing in their clubs, not all games, but a lot of games. Again, I was playing with older guys, also players that are now currently top level. So it was pretty tough, you know, like coming back from the national team and not playing. That was a very tough time. But yeah, like I kind of made it through the season, collecting my games for the national team. Of course, the first national, I will never forget my first game. There was a game in Belgium. I didn't play the first game. Normally you always have like on like national team break, you always have two games. So for example, you're going to play against Belgium, you will have two games in Belgium on different locations. So the first game, I remember like all my family members were coming over, godfather, you know, like friends, everyone was there. And I wasn't playing because I was a new guy in the national team. You know, I had to gain respect first. There were all those established players from all the top teams. So I was, sorry to say that, but I was pissed, of course, because they were coming all the way. And I wasn't playing. Fortunately for me, we lost this game badly against Belgium. I was playing center back at that time, and the next game that we played against Belgium, I was starting, and we were winning 1-0. And that was you always have to be lucky. So in this case, I was lucky. I had a good game, good start. You know, hearing the anthem at the beginning was insane. It gave me goosebumps. Yeah. Everything as I'm standing on the pitch. Probably the same for you guys when you hear the American.
You know, it's not quite the same when you don't have your national team kit on, but it's still good. Okay.
That might be right, but it's still the anthem, so
yeah, it is.
So that was my first experience, and then you know, like how it goes. I was re-invited to the next break. I did a pretty decent job, and then I, you know, like kept moving into the U17. Like I was the older player now in my club team. So in the U17, and probably you guys know that, you normally have the chance to participate in the European Championship, and if you qualify for the World Cup or World Championship, also for the World Cup. So in this case, I was invited for the qualifiers. We won against, we played against Ukraine. I think it was Ukraine, Italy, and Slovenia, I think. And we were like winning the group, so we made it to the European Championship. Everything in 1 year, 2015. So the year started with the qualifiers. Then the second the second event was the European Championship, which took place in Bulgaria back then. And I don't know, like, do you want me to guide you through this whole tournament or?
Yeah, literally.
The
next question I was literally about to ask you, I was going to say, what was it like playing in the Euros and the World Cup qualifiers? So go ahead, man, talk to us.
Yeah, this is super interesting for sure.
Okay. Like I said, the European Championship was in Bulgaria. And our group stage was against Belgium, the first game, Slovakia, the second game, and the third game against Czech Republic. And we were like super nervous. Nobody of us ever experienced something like that, you know, like playing in a big stadium. Not that many visitors, to be honest, or spectators, but that's normal, of course, because no one really cares about U17 players. But I would say still like probably around like maybe 4,000 people in the stadium. And then we, we played against Belgium, our first game. You guys know how it is, best team in the group. So you got to win this, or you better win this game to move forward. And we won 2-0, which was great. I was starting as a center back, actually with a colleague from Leverkusen back then. So that was pretty cool. And then we just kept going. We played against Slovakia, won 1-0, played against Czech Republic and won 4-0. So clean sheet for all three games, which was a big push for us as center backs, of course, or for the back line overall. And it was pretty funny because every team was in one hotel, like a big hotel complex. And after the group stage, like everyone was, you know, like waving the teams away that had to leave. so that was pretty cool. And of course, only the top teams stayed in the hotel. Then after the group stage, the quarterfinals were coming. So we were actually playing against our fear opponents, which was Spain back then. We lost against them on our scrimmage games 2 times in a row. So that was pretty tough. We were all pretty nervous. And they also had very good players like Dani Olmo, for example, from Leipzig, Alenia from Barcelona, and Cucurella, like crazy players. And we somehow made it to overtime. And overtime immediately meant penalties back then. We were having penalties. And of course, as a center back, you're not allowed to shoot a penalty. But to be honest, normally here at Drexel, I would always go for it. But I was so nervous standing there. It was like we won the penalties. And it was crazy. Like we were going crazy after the game because this game actually meant if you would win or if you win your quarterfinals, you would make it, or that's your qualification for the World Cup. So that was a very important game. So we won it and we were qualified for the World Cup. And then, then we played against Russia in the semifinals. They had a very strengthful and tough team, as you can imagine. And we won 1-0 again. So again, clean sheet. So that was actually I'm not sure exactly if it was the first time overall for German U17 to make it to the finals without a conceded goal, but it was rarely seen before, so that was very nice for us as a back line. And then we played unfortunately against France in the final. I can tell you, so the two center backs back then were Upamecano from Bayern Munich and Konate from Liverpool. I don't think that they have grown from the U17 to what they are now. So it's kind of insane how tall they were. I don't know, Edouard, for example, striker who was playing for PSG. What is his name? Eboué, for example, I think he's playing for Lyon. Awa also playing for Lyon, like very good players. We just lost. Like we didn't have a chance at all, to be honest. We lost 4-1. So they won it. It was very very sad, of course, but it wasn't as sad as if it would have been a little bit closer. You know, like it was just so dominant. I was just like, okay. Guys, you deserve it. That was honestly not fair. But it was pretty fun. And it was a great experience, of course. Coming back, we had this whole complex in the hotel, and we were the only two teams left at the end for like 5 or 6 days. We didn't see them once. Maybe a funny story on the side. So the evening before we actually had the game, someone of the French team sneaked into our corridor, like where all of our rooms were, and we had like a poster in the like the main hall of this corridor, and they were like writing down French sentences like "we are going to destroy you tomorrow" and this kind of stuff, which was kind of frightening, of course. it was a lot of fun, and like 5 or 6 weeks overall, so a lot of time.
as a 16-year-old, I can't imagine like watching game film and seeing Upamecano and Konate that size at 16 years old. Like, that's insane.
It was like a friend of my dad was there, and we were meeting after the game, and he was like joking on the team because he was like, "Yo, this center back could be your father, actually." Like, it was the difference was so huge. It was just, yeah. To be honest, it was not fair.
That's how it is.
And they
sounded like you needed a prime Kai to score some goals on them too in that game. That's crazy.
You know, at least you can watch them now like succeed in the Champions League final, and you're like, oh, they were just really, really
definitely. That's what I'm telling myself every time.
That's awesome. Thanks for taking us into that run, dude. That sounds so cool. And congratulations too on everything that you achieved at the youth national team level. So
So
again, shifting back into kind of our timeline here. So where we wanted to take it next was, so obviously at the U19 level, the youth level is over, right? So your time at Leverkusen was forced to end unless you got signed for the first team. And so you were forced to move on. And so obviously, as I mentioned in the beginning, you had 2 fourth tier teams, I believe, that you played for 4 years. So what was it like, making that step to the semi-professional level, but also, you know, bouncing between clubs, I guess, in just such a short time? And in 2 years, you moved on from Cologne. So what was that like for you?
Mm-hmm. I would say the biggest difference is just adapting to playing with and against people that are, you know, like 35 sometimes, 30 years old, completely matured. You're coming out of the U19, so you're normally 18, and you still have to develop. Of course, there are players that are already developed, but I would say I still had to figure out, you know, like it took me a while to adapt, like almost every guy that was coming up out of the U19 in my team. And then just like you mentioned that I was switching teams after like 2 years. So normally in the second team, especially in Cologne back then, and we talked about it before I actually signed the contract back then. At Cologne, it was like this, that you had to move on after 2 years if you don't make it to the first team, which in my opinion also makes sense. You know, like they have the chance to see you over 2 years. You can develop in those 2 years. If you are really and like super good for this level, then you would make the step, in my opinion. Of course, it always depends. You have to be cautious talking about that, but it always depends on, coaches. Do they like you? What about changes in management, for example? So for me, it was pretty unfortunate back then when I came out of the U19. The contract that I signed, or the coach that I talked to, he was leaving the club to the season where I actually moved there. So I signed the contract in February. He signed his contract with the professional team in, I don't know, May, I think. And the season started in June or July. So new coach coming in. He didn't like me that much. I didn't like him. He was also, he had to leave the team after half the season because he was a very bad coach, as they saw, like, after a few months. But, that was something that, like, put me back a little bit. New coach was coming in, you know, like, I got the chance to play again. So it was, like, back and forth at Cologne over 2 years, actually. And I was staying fit. I never had, like, big problems with being injured, which was very good and which was I was like very thankful for. And then after Cologne, I had to decide, okay, what is the next step? I definitely want to keep trying because I was only like 20 years old. And then I moved to Wuppertal SV, which is like a big traditional club in Germany overall, but especially in the fourth division. So they were playing first tier, I don't know how many years ago, probably like 15 or 20 years ago. But again, still a very good club in the fourth division. If you look up the schedule right now, I think they were like in third place, second place or whatever. So they gave me the chance to go there. I had very good coaches over there, a lot of support. I was playing a lot of the games. almost like all games. And then out of nowhere, I got injured for like the second year, which was all like during the first year, actually, after half of the year, which was very unfortunate because you guys know how it works. Like I was feeling comfortable. I was playing. Yeah. Everything was going well. And then you get an injury, and I got a inflammation in my pubic bone. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but it takes a while. Inflammations always takes a while or take a while. So in this case, I was out for 10 months in a row, which is, of course, bad luck. But yeah, I kind of fought back. Yeah, was trying to, you know, practice again, train again, get into the team again. Had my minutes when I came back for the last half of the second season at Wuppertal. And then I thought about, okay, what are my options now? So I'm not 18 anymore. So in Germany, normally I would say to make it to the first two tiers, you got to make it up pretty fast, you know, like not like Kai Havertz, that's maybe a little bit too fast, but normally like after your U19 career or like your youth career, you got to go up after like 2 years, maybe 3 years. But after 4 years, you got to question yourself, in my opinion. And a lot of players don't do that. They just, you know, like keep moving, try to keep moving forward without doing anything next to it, which is always a problem. Mm-hmm. And so I looked up, I did some research on, you know, like scholarships in the US, and that's how I came here. That's, of course, another chapter of my life, which is also kind of complex, but yeah, that's everything that I have to tell you guys about my 4 years in the first year.
Yeah, well, you know, the whole reason the show is called Around the World is because it's based on the fact that soccer can take guys all around the world, guys and girls all around the world. You know, we had Victor on from Iceland in our first episode, and we were just saying, man, without soccer, we wouldn't even know you. So at least you had soccer to bring you here stateside, and you get a chance to pursue your master's, and we get to meet you. But that kind of ties in just to the last question that we want to ask you before we move on to winners and losers. So you are here in America, and you're getting your master's at Drexel. But obviously that means that you had to pursue an undergraduate degree over in Germany, which not a ton of guys do if they're in the ranks of a top youth academy, because as you mentioned, that takes so much of your life. So I can imagine it's difficult to balance soccer and school when you're playing at such a high level. So just real quick then, can you talk to us about what it's like, what it was like for you pursuing that undergraduate degree while playing for Bayer?
Yeah, of course. The beginning was actually, everything started after my high school graduation, which was during my U19, during the last year of my U19 season overall. And I just gave soccer a chance, you know, like I wanted to get away from the academic part just to see, okay, how is it having only soccer without anything else? And I remember the time I was going to the gym, I was working out, I was playing soccer once or twice a day, but I wasn't doing anything else. And I kind of figured out for myself, okay, that's not how it should be for myself. I was bored, I was missing something. And I was like, okay, I always wanted to study. The question was only, when do I want to start to study? Also depended on, you know, like if I make it to professional soccer or not. But since I, you know, was going to the fourth division, I was like, okay, give it a shot. Just start it. You don't know how fast you will go through the whole undergrad stuff, but I think it's always important to start. Not only like telling guys or people something about it, but you actually have to start at some point. Mm-hmm. And then I started. I think I was the first guy doing it at my team back then, which paid off now, as you will hear later. But so like I started it. I did sports management and communication at a very famous school in Cologne, which was perfect for me because I was playing for Cologne FC. The university was in Cologne, so that was pretty cool. It's very hard. Like the system is different. We don't have this connection between college and soccer like we have it right now here in the US. So everything is separated from each other, like I said in the beginning, and it's pretty tough to, you know, like participate in all seminars and all lectures. I think throughout my whole curriculum, I was only able to join one lecture out of 10, probably. So I always had to redo my stuff, like look over the stuff on my own in the evening when I came back, which is pretty tough most of the times. But again, it paid off. I somehow made it through pretty fast. Normally, I would say an average duration of an athlete in Germany to study is probably around, so we also have semesters normally. So I would say at least like 10 semesters. There are players who are doing it over, you know, like sometimes, I don't know, 8 years, 10 years, just so that they are ready when they are, you know, done with their soccer career. But I was done after 4 years. And that was extremely helpful for me for the whole process of, you know, like coming to the US, because eligibility here is very strict. So you only get normally, or like, looking back or like looking at the overall years of eligibility that you could get, you get like 5 years, right? So because of COVID, maybe six, but I already had 4 years spent with my undergrad in Germany. So I only had 1 year left. If it would have been, you know, the case that I would study 5 years, it wouldn't be possible anymore. So I was pretty happy at that point. And yeah, fortunately, I got the second year of eligibility, which is also pretty nice. But that's a different topic.
No, I'm sure that's it's probably a very unique story, because I know how strict they are here. But no, that's awesome, dude. And like, I think, you know, that speaks to who you are, because I know I'm sitting in my room complaining about college soccer, like me trying to do school while playing college soccer, but I can't imagine being basically a full-time pro doing it. So, and also doing school. So that's awesome. And kudos to you. It shows your work ethic. And, like when you prioritize something, you get it done. So that's awesome, dude. And obviously you're at Drexel now and have one more season, I believe, as you said, and, hopefully you guys have a good season, and we're rooting for you specifically and the team too. So Thanks, Daniel, for sharing your story. That's awesome, man.
Of course.
Yeah. So as Dill mentioned, now we're going to move into our winners losers segment. For those who don't know, me, Daniel, and Dylan are going to go around and give our biggest winner and loser of the week in the soccer world. It could be anything, across any league in any country. And so Dylan, do you want to kick us off today?
Yeah, sure. So for my winner, I'm going to keep it local. I'm going to stay in the States, and I'm going to say LAFC is the big winner this week. So when we're looking at them, they're already in first place in MLS. They already have a really strong roster with guys like Carlos Vela, who's, you know, arguably the face of the league or one of the best players in the league. And then they add Chiellini, which is a huge signing, not only just for LAFC, but for MLS, having a just an internationally renowned defender and a champion come over to the league. And now we hear breaking is Gareth Bale has intentions of joining LAFC. So we're just looking at a team that's set to dominate the entire league, which is something that I don't know that we've seen a ton in MLS. We haven't seen a wire-to-wire just best team, just dogging everybody, kind of how Daniel was saying, you got to dominate to win the league. I think in MLS sometimes you don't have to dominate because there's playoffs, you just got to get into the playoffs. But I think it's really cool that we have a chance to see a team dominate every game, the entire league, and then we'll see how it goes into the playoffs. But overall for MLS, it's huge. For LAFC, they're totally stacked. They're probably too stacked for the league, and it's really cool. So I'm looking forward to see Bale play for LAFC, and they're my winner.
Yeah, no, when you were speaking, I was thinking about how this, like, as you're saying, like a dominant team potentially being formed here, and on paper, obviously they are, and what that could do for the league. I feel like it could push it faster, like for teams to catch up, right? Because I don't know if that's, you know, obviously since I've been alive, all the big leagues in Europe have just been massive. And so we're still looking at a growing league with the MLS, and in order for it to grow, maybe this is a start, getting a team that, you know, is clearly dominant and other teams have to catch up faster. And, you know, I agree with you. I think it's a great thing for the league, and, you know, we'll see where it goes. But I think, yeah, as you said, like, it's on paper, it's an insane team.
I agree. Like, I will also say that it's very important for the league, just to get or gain more attention overall worldwide. But I think on the other side, it's also dangerous for the team specifically, you know, like for LA, just because we've seen so many teams that try to bring together all the stars. Of course, right now it's working out, but where's the point, you know, like when it's maybe getting a little bit too much and you kind of lose the team spirit, because maybe, I don't know, like Gareth Bale maybe just wants to have a good time in LA and he just wants to get money, which could also be the case, even
play
though
he golf.
Was saying something different. Yeah. do a little bit of surfing, for example. But yeah, I don't know. This is always a very dangerous part of it.
I guess now it's Wales Golf LAFC.
Yeah. Probably.
Oh man, that's funny. No, that's good. Yeah, no, I agree. That's a good point to bring up, Daniel, about the other side of it. So do you want to have your winner, or tell the audience your winner as well?
Yep. That's a random one. And I don't know if a lot of people know this guy, but he's a goalkeeper who went from I wouldn't say bad first division club in Germany, but not a very good club in Germany, to Man City. His name is Stefan Ortega, and he was doing a pretty good job in his club over the last few seasons. And he has a lot of ambition to actually play at Man City. And I'm curious, like, that could be a story, like a surprisingly good story for him, because I know that Man City normally puts it this way, that one guy is playing for the cup, one is playing the season. And if he kind of makes it, you know, like, you never know, you got to be lucky. Ederson, for example, just has to be injured, which I don't hope, of course, but yeah, that could be a big chance for him. And then we would see a player playing on one of the top teams worldwide that nobody actually heard about before. So yeah. This is kind of funny, and I think a very nice story.
Yeah, that'd be super cool. It's always awesome to see guys get their chances. Obviously, he was performing well at his club, even though maybe not everybody was seeing it day to day. And now he's getting a chance at City. And I think he's actually going to slot in perfectly to that cup goalie role, because I think they don't love Zach Steffen anymore. I think he struggled, even though we're American and, you know, we root all our American players on. He didn't do great last year. So I think that space is open, that spot is open. I think they might have even loaned Stefan out already.
They did, yeah.
So he's looking like he'll get some minutes, hopefully.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and as Daniel said, it's just takes one chance of luck and getting your chance to play, and, you know, who knows what can happen, man. And, you know, obviously he flew under the radar. I mean, like, as you mentioned, like, I don't know. I didn't hear he was getting linked to other big clubs, and Man City's taking a chance on him and saw something, and, you know, we'll see what happens. And as a City fan, I'm excited to have players like that come in. So, so for my winner this week, this is actually a pretty funny one. So my winner this week is going to be the FC Barcelona accountants. And so, okay. How are they getting all this money? How are they getting the money for these players is beyond me. And that's why the financial team there at FC Barcelona is getting a shout out for me this week, because, you know, I can't fathom how, like, I saw this video on Bleacher Report today about, it was like an animated one with like cartoon Xavi going around couches and like picking up pocket chains to like change to sign Rafinha, because like literally that's what it seems like when you look at, they have to pay Frankie de Jong like $20 million. And they were already in a bad financial place before this. And, you know, where is it coming from? I don't know, but like massive signing for them with Rafinha. I'm very high on him, and I think, you know, he's going to do great for them. And, you know, if there's also buzz going around about Lewandowski, and that's like his first choice, and who knows how they're going to afford that. But if they somehow do, that would be insane. So that's my shout out of the week. And, you know, I guess good business for FC Barcelona. I don't know how, but good business.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, just looking at how much the club is in debt still, and being able to get these kind of players, I think it's kind of still related or connected to the name of the brand, you know, like Barcelona. we would all love to play for Barcelona. We grew up with, you know, Barcelona being one of the best clubs over such a long period of time. So I think it's still like the name plays into, but I think they have a lot of support from the state, like backup from the state. You know, that debt is not going on their sheets anymore, which maybe allows them to get new players. But yeah, it's difficult. In my opinion, it shouldn't be that this way. And that's why I don't really like the Premier League for it, because it's so risky. You know, like if you look at their debt positions, it's insane. But that's where soccer is going right now. So let's see where it's going.
Yeah, I just keep waiting to see a headline come out that like Barcelona's been relegated because they've just broken so many financial rules, kind of like Juve, you know, a couple of years ago. We were talking about this just during the week when we were putting out the episode. We're just like, where is this money coming? Like, it doesn't exist. The money does not exist. Giving out, like, I don't understand it. Like, I could tell Frankie De Jong I'm going to give him 20 million. Like, anybody can say it. Like, where's the money?
Yeah,
I don't get it. Maybe it's all the weddings that they're hosting at the Spotify Camp Nou right now, but I don't know how they're getting away with it. So it's a great shout, Jax, but I'm still waiting. I'm still waiting for something to come out because there's just something off about this whole thing.
Oh, that's funny.
So then we have losers. Daniel, do you want to kick this one off? Because I know we see eye to eye on this one.
Okay, so I'm coming up with the discussion about Super League. I think soccer overall is a loser this week. Just looking at this discussion again, I'm not a big fan of this whole Super League topic. I know, again, like I accept that they are trying to, you know, like capitalize on soccer. At the end of the day, every industry is doing it, so why shouldn't soccer do it? But soccer is different, in my opinion, or differs from other industries, just because it's not only about money. And we kind of touched on that, the question before, like the topic about the winners. I think there should be a limit at some point. You know, it cannot always go up. At some point, you gotta be humble and realistic. Okay, how much is it actually worth to get a player? How much is it worth to let players play, I don't know, 70, 80 games per season, just because you want to capitalize on it? This is a very tough topic. In my opinion, it's not going to happen, even though they are going to court now. But yeah, this is, it's kind of sad for soccer because this is kind of splitting up soccer. And it doesn't matter which kind of topic you're talking, politics, whatever, like religion, it's always, you know, like this kind of stuff splits us up. And yeah, it's kind of sad, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, you know, for those before we start recording every episode, we hop in the call and we go over our winners and losers to make sure that we don't have any overlap. And I actually had the same exact one as Daniel. I audible, I got my own this week, but I'm with you, Daniel. I just think it's not good for the sport. I think it's just part of culture. I was fortunate enough to live in England for 3 years. Daniel, you obviously grew up in Germany. I think it's coming in America, but it's just something that is a huge part of people's lives, and it's just so much bigger than money. A lot of people work all week just to be able to pay for their tickets on the, you know, on the weekend, and those are already getting too expensive as it is. So I'm with you. I don't think it'll happen. I obviously really hope it doesn't. If you want three clubs to be mad at, it's Juventus, Real Madrid, and Barcelona. So yep. Go ahead and
now we know where the motivation is for Barcelona.
Yeah, exactly. They need it. They need it. But I'm with you, man. Hopefully there is a chance that if it goes the way that we want it to, it'll be permanently banned. So that could be a good thing. It, you know, won't get brought up again, but fingers crossed.
Yeah, I have nothing else to add. I think you guys hit it home and I agree with you all. And, you know, I'm completely on your guys' side, and I hope it, you know, gets squashed. So we'll see. But
Dill, one thing ready? I will say, and I'll give mine right after this. But one thing I will say is it was really cool when it initially came out and they were really trying to make the push for it to see the entire soccer world come together like you've never seen. I mean, clubs that hate each other, marching in the streets together, you know, all the fans of the most beautiful, most popular game in the world came together, shut it down real quick. So that was pretty cool to see. And hopefully we don't have to do that again.
I agree.
My loser is a loser with a caveat. My loser is going to be Gabriel Slonina, the Chicago Fire goalie. He's killing it right now in MLS. He obviously came out before the season and said, I want to set the shutout record. He's still 18 years old, and the news is coming out that he is being linked with the 10 million euro, I believe, or pounds, I'm not sure, move to Chelsea. And so, listen, he's not going to be my loser because he's getting linked with one of the top clubs in the world. That would be super awesome. But he's going to be my loser if he goes there and sits on the bench and stunts his development at 18 years old. Daniel said it as a guy who's seen it firsthand. The window is small, and even though he's killing it right now in MLS, he still has to keep growing because in 3 years he will truly be judged as a 21-year-old looking to play at the top level in the world. So, like, if there's a situation where Chelsea buys him and then they loan him back, awesome. You know, I take him off my loser for the week because – you know, there's not much loser about that situation. But if he goes there and he rots away on the bench, I just think it's a ton of potential that could be wasted. So that's going to be my loser for the week.
Yeah, Dylan, I think we've seen it firsthand with U.S. goalkeepers. We've seen it with Zach Steffen. Even I think Ethan Horvath at Nottingham, like same situation. And now potentially we're seeing it with Matt Turner, and obviously he has different intentions going to Arsenal, but you know, it's a tough situation. And, you know, one thing I will say though, is, you know, Chelsea's known for, you know, buying assets early and loaning out. So as you mentioned, hopefully that's the situation and he can get game time and obviously not stint his development, as you said, but you know, we'll see. And you know, if it goes as you mentioned, then obviously it is a huge loser for United States.
Yeah. So Dylan, I agree with you on that point that it's not going to be good if he would stay there like Steffen, for example, you know, because you always want to try to reach your limit at some point. And you couldn't reach it if you stick with that club and being in the second position. But I think in this case, it's a good decision of him, just because it is probably a unique, you know, like decision, but also offer, because you never know what's going to happen in the upcoming season. It can always happen, you know, like you're kind of getting injured, you're getting out of attention. It's very dynamic and fast paced in soccer. So having this kind of deal, this will allow him, doesn't matter if he's going to play or not, or even if he will be injured at Chelsea, for example, he will still have it on his resume. You know, like he will be a Chelsea player. A lot of clubs will look at him when he moves. So he will definitely have a chance to move to like a, you know, a worse Premier League club, for example, afterwards. So I think that's exactly what Drex was talking about. That's the chance that you want to look for and that you just have to grab at some point. Because again, like I experienced it also in Germany on a lower level, of course, but people were sometimes missing this step, you know, like to make it to professional soccer because they were saying, okay, I put the focus on, I want to play. At the end of the day, best case would be you go up and you play, you know, like you don't have to be that, you know, like pessimistic, I would say. sometimes you just got to grab the chance.
Yeah, like you're talking about with Stefan Ortega. Got to take it, right? Got to take the chance.
Definitely.
Yeah. So to end us here, my loser of the week. Now, this is I was in a bit of a pickle but as I picked this before some big news came out surrounding the club, but I'm still going to stick with it. So it's going to be DC United this week for me. And so why I picked DC United was the 7-0 thrashing that occurred last week at Philly Union, that it all kind of came together. And, you know, like I grew up in the Maryland area. So obviously DC United was my MLS team. And like, I was kind of forced into that. And, you know, I did grow up supporting them. I went to games and, you know, we were decent back then. It was actually like, you know, a good time. And where the club's at now compared to where it was back then when Ben Olsen was a player is completely night and day. So I don't see what they're trying to do. I literally do not see selling Luciano Acosta, like our best player. Okay. We don't go get anyone. Like, as we mentioned, we see LAFC getting all these stars. Like, we should have the money to go get stars, and DC United didn't get any stars. It's a situation where, you know, I don't see progression. Now, obviously the big news I'm talking about is Wayne Rooney being announced as the next head coach. And, you know, I think he garnished a lot of respect in England with his, you know, role at Derby County. And I think he's formidable, and I think he could do a job. I just worried that they won't give him enough time, because, you know, they did give Ben Olsen a lot of time, and, you know, but they, I'm hoping they do the same for Rooney, but who knows, you never know in this world. So I just hope everything gets turned around and Rooney does a good job, but for right now they're my loser, and I'm interested to see Rooney's got his work cut out for him as the new manager. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, maybe I can give my comment on that first, Dylan. I think I talked to some people from the union, but also like to players from the US in college, and we kind of like talked about that beforehand early on in the interview, that academies are getting more important, and I think especially for cities like Philadelphia and Washington DC, for example, where you don't have a backup like in Miami or, you know, like LA with so huge investors or like such a nice environment. I mean, I love Philly. I also like DC a lot, to be honest, but it's not the same as you would live in Miami, of course. So in this case, they got to figure out, and I would say Philly is doing a pretty good job doing it with the academy. You got to figure out that you come up with a very strong youth academy, because the trend is towards youth academies. It will grow. The attention is growing right now for soccer in the US. So that would be a strategic plan where I would say, okay, then they are actually tackling the problem. It's not about, I wouldn't say it's about like getting, you know, like the best stars, because you kind of can't afford them maybe at some point, but it's more about like maybe homegrown players, you know, like bringing them into the first team after a while. I think that should be an approach.
Yeah. No, my comment was going to be very similar. I was just going to say, you know, what every sports fan wants for their team is obviously to win. But if you're not winning, what you want is a plan, and you want a direction, and you want to say, okay, we're not winning this season or next season, but in five seasons, this is why we're going to win, because we're doing this now. And okay, you're not going to win every year, but you got a plan, you have a direction, you know what the future holds. And, you know, it just seems like they don't have that plan, that big picture idea that, you know, they're probably not going to win it this year or next year, but they're probably not going to win it in 5 years too. So what can they do now? I agree, Daniel, that build through the academy. What can they do to ensure that there is success somewhere along the line? And I think that's probably what most DC United fans are looking for.
Right. Yeah, it has to be something. It has to be a direction, as you're mentioning. And, you know, if you like Daniel brought it up, the comparing Philly Union to DC United, it's night and day with the academy. Like it's DC United is nowhere near as far along as Philadelphia Union is in that regard. So it's got to be something. And, you know, that's why they're my loser. So. Yeah.
All right, last segment of the episode now. We're just going to move on to spin the wheel. We have a wheel with Europe's top five leagues on it. Whatever it lands on, we're just going to talk about the most interesting thing happening in that league or with a player in that league. We have no idea what's coming up, so we're just as – all right. Wow. Oh, it was almost in the middle. But this is fitting. It landed on the Bundesliga.
Daniel, you gotta know some inside.
Okay. So I would say it's gonna be very interesting to see again after I don't know how many seasons, probably like 10 seasons in a row, if Dortmund is actually finally able to compete with Bayern Munich. I would say like people are always looking at transfer records like in preseason or before the actual season. And with the signing of Sadio Mane, for example, Bayern, of course, hit some like a good player, in my opinion. But Dortmund also kind of always have good players coming in. It's just a question of, okay, like, are they actually able to compete at some point, because right now, maybe Leipzig, but I don't still don't see any kind of like any other club competing with Munich. So this is always the questions that I, like everyone asks himself or herself, like, are they actually going to make it? And again, this year, I think the ambitions are still very high. And at some point, it just got to happen.
Yeah, it's something, you know, we talked about a little bit on earlier. And it's just like, it's not really like Dortmund's getting closer, you know. And one big piece of that, hopefully our boy Gio Reyna can stay healthy. He's a really, really talented player. I think he'd be a huge part of that team. And I think we're all rooting for Dortmund a little bit, at least to make it close, just from a neutral perspective. It'd be fun to see the Bundesliga get shaken up a little bit. But I'm with you. I don't know if it'll happen this year. Bayern's getting stronger. They might lose Lewandowski, but they're getting stronger. Hopefully Dortmund can bring in some guys or bring some guys up from the academy, and it can be a fun race, and hopefully Leipzig gets involved too. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know. I can't remember if Haller was confirmed. Like, did he officially move to Dortmund?
Yep.
He did. Okay. So that's a good, yeah, it's a good signing. A good signing. I mean, like, not even close to Haaland, but good signing. Right. So, yeah. You know, but as you mentioned, like, it's, you know, you look at Mane, you look at Haller, you know, obviously everyone's looking at Mane. So there's, you know, I'm in the same boat though. I think, you know, I enjoy watching the Bundesliga. I think it's an awesome league, and, you know, it's kind of take some life out of it sometimes, when you can look at a Prem where at least maybe it's a two-legged race now with Liverpool and City, or you could look at Bayern pretty much thrash every weekend. So it's tough, but, you know, as we all said, I think it's good for the league if Dortmund could come along and Leipzig. So,
and for me, it's also like maybe a second point, because I'm actually a Schalke fan. Okay. I was growing up being a Schalke fan. So we relegated last year, now promoted again. So I'm kind of curious how they will figure it out. They were in a very bad position financially. Kind of like, you know, like all the top clubs like Real Madrid and Barcelona, for example, they actually had to relegate because of that. So in this case, I'm curious if they will, you know, stay in the league and can somehow compete, because looking at their roster right now, I don't see that happening. But that's always like the perspective from a fan. So
yeah. At least you're getting the derby back against Dortmund. So
that's right. Fun. That's right.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. That does it for episode 6. We're so excited to have you on today. We had so much fun. You have so much to share, and not only the listeners, but I think Drags and myself are going to be able to take a lot away from this. You have done so many just really awesome things in the soccer world, and you know, you'll continue to do them next year at Drexel. So thanks so much for hopping on and chatting with us. Time flew and had a ton of fun. So thanks, man. For all the listeners, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. Check us out on Instagram at Around the World Pod, also on Twitter. And we have a YouTube that will be launching soon, so you can check us out there at Around the World. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you next week.